have not butchered that. And it's 3 o'clock. Time now for Cover to Cover with Jack Foley.
This is Jack Foley, and I often say that my guest today is a very special one, and they all are special ones. But today's guest is a very, very special one. Today's guest is my son, Sean, S-E-A-N, Sean Foley, and in fact, Dr. Sean Foley. He has just published a really exciting, fascinating book, The Arab Gulf States Beyond Oil and Islam. The Arab Gulf States Beyond Oil and Islam. And we'll talk about that title and what it might mean soon. The publisher is Lynn Reiner Publishers, and that's spelled a little oddly. Lynn is L-Y-N-N-E, and Reiner is R-I-E-N-N-E-R. Lynn Reiner Publishers. They are specialists in the Middle East, and this is a book, of course, about the Arab Gulf states, and so a book about the Middle East. Sean is a historian who teaches at Middle Tennessee State University in Tennessee, in near Nashville. And that's one of his great subjects, the Middle East. Dr. Foley, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And somewhat surprising, we're actually recording this in the home where Sean grew up, so it's a kind of full circle. Tell me a little bit about the book, and particularly in the opening passages of the book, we have a famous poet. His name is Amiri Baraka. We have a president. His name is Barack Obama. In both cases, there's that word Barack, Baraka, or as it's more properly pronounced, Baraka.
Or Baraka, blessings, yes.
And tell me about your adventure with Baraka.
Well, Baraka, the story that I begin with was actually a project related to something very different than this. What the subject of this book. I was in Syria writing my doctoral dissertation on a 19th century Sufi sheikh, a man named Sheikh Khalid. And I met a man named Sheikh Nazim al-Kubrisi. And Sheikh Nazim is the foremost follower of Sheikh Khalid in the world today, a very important man originally from Turkey, but a man who spends a lot of time today in Damascus, Syria, where I met him. And I was formally introduced to him, and we had a long conversation. It began in Arabic, but we switched to English because it was the only language that everyone in the room, including both Arabs but also people from parts of the Muslim world that didn't speak Arabic, including Southeast Asia and Turkey, and even people from Europe and America, could understand. And after the conversation, maybe 10 minutes or so, I talked to a group of his followers. We're very excited. And they began to touch me in sort of ways that sort of touch my arm, touch my hands, sort of put their arms behind my back.
Not a threatening kind of touching or
no,
anything?
No, and in fact, I was not even worried at first because in the Arab world, direct interaction between heterosexual men is far more common. When men meet each other, they kiss each other multiple times. It's not uncommon to see heterosexual men walk hand in hand in the street or to display much more overt displays of connection.
Rather as women do in the West.
Right, that's right. And so at first I kind of thought that's what was going on. And then as it went on and on, and then one of them asked me an important question. He looked down at my backpack that was next to me, and did he say, did the Sheikh touch this backpack? And I realized what was going on. These men believed that Sheikh Nazim, like Sheikh Khalid before him, was a Muslim saint. And Muslim saints, even living ones, are believed to have baraka or blessings. And the idea directly from God, it's transmitted out to the world. And because I had interacted with Sheikh Nazim for an extended period of time, these men believed that I had benefited, that the baraka or blessings that man receives through these saints from God into the world. And that's why they were touching me.
You were carrying it around with you like a kind of invisible shield or something.
Something like that, or money was hanging from me or something. They wanted it.
Yeah.
They wanted good news. I thought, okay, fine. And I had to go back to the States, and then I came back through the airport in London, And while I was going to the airport in London, I saw, just by accident, the National Geographic. Again, you mentioned being at my home growing up. I remember reading the National Geographic up to a certain point, maybe third or fourth grade, but afterwards it wasn't something I was as interested in. So this is the first time I'd really looked at the National Geographic in a long time.
Yeah.
And I took a look at a cover, and it was a Saudi prince doing a sword dance, called an Arda sword dance, on this thing. And it was an article.
Why was he doing that? He was not a performer.
No, it was a political statement. It was done as part of a ceremony of alliance, of mutual alliance and loyalty between a Saudi prince and this community that he was doing it in. And the article featured all kinds of articles and pictures inside Saudi Arabia. The author was given access to virtually every level of Saudi society, both Saudis, also the significant population of foreigners, poor and rich, all appeared throughout this article. And it got my mind thinking. This was very different than the types of societies that I'd read about in graduate school at Georgetown, and before that as an undergraduate at the University of California, Berkeley. And the theories and the ideas that I had to study and master in graduate school didn't explain this. And
now, it was really interesting because you're getting something from something like popular culture, National Geographic, and it's turning you around vis-a-vis the field in which you are an expert and in which you've read other experts. Suddenly you find something that the things that people are saying can't explain.
Right, and it also reminded me of things when I'd been in that part of the world before that hadn't, you know, linked up. That, you know, I'd spent time in the Gulf.
It made you make sense of your own experience, too.
Or reminded me of things that I always thought about that had bothered me.
What are some of these kinds of things that it began to teach you and to show you?
Well, it made me think for a second about types of ways of thinking in these societies that didn't necessarily begin and end with oil or with Islam. It's where the title of the book came from, that there were political things, there were cultural aspects of these societies, the way people interact, that couldn't be explained just through religion or a certain type of economic interaction relating to oil. And the idea was, as I looked at that, I said, I need to think about this. Now, I was writing another dissertation. I had to get that done. But that process began to lead me to think. To first give a conference paper on the subject at the Middle Eastern Studies Association annual conference, and then to write the book to say, I don't agree with the way that the majority of the people in the field look at this subject,
and I need to think about
it differently.
Sure. Part of what you don't agree with is something called the Rentier theory, and tell us about that. You make a very interesting point in talking about that in relationship to the fees that were made, the money that was made from the Hajj in the 30s by Saudi Arabia. The Rentier theory was invented to do what?
It was invented in the early 1970s to explain socioeconomic transformation of societies that occurred very rapidly when a lot of money from oil, as many of your listeners may know, oil prices increased several points in the 1970s dramatically.
And we're talking about a period, too, of 50 years, about 1931 to 1981, is that
right.
correct?
Right, that's the sort of first period where this occurred, where these societies that had been relatively poor, by regional standards, suddenly became fabulously wealthy.
Yeah, zoom, right away.
In a hurry. Yeah. How do you explain this? And in fact, one of the principal initial reasons was oil, and that there were seemingly social transformations that occurred in these societies. And what's important when we think about this is that in most other parts of the world outside of the United States, the oil under the ground is owned by the state. It's not necessarily owned by the individuals above.
Not a company.
Not a company or an individual. It's owned by the state. That meant that when oil was discovered in these regions, it meant suddenly the state got very, very wealthy and had resources that were not available to the rest of society.
Now, some of the people in your field said, aha, that tells me something about the entirety of the society. Once oil happens, everything changes.
That's correct. And the sort of model sort of this was, of course, Saudi Arabia, but there are other states as well, Kuwait, Oman, other places. Again, when we talk about the Gulf states, it's sort of a term many of your listeners may not be familiar with. What I mean with are conservative monarchies in the Persian Gulf region.
Let's name them.
Sure.
Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates.
And, of course, Kuwait.
Kuwait, yes.
Yes, yeah.
And they collectively are referred to as the Gulf Cooperation Council, or the GCC.
That's right. Or the Gulf states in Arabic, we might say Al-Khalij, which is the Gulf. And so people from the region are known as Khalijis, people who are from this part of the world. It is a region dominated by Sunni Arabs. This is the two distinctions. The largest community within the Muslim community are Sunni Arabs, although there are large pockets of Shia Arabs as well. There are also people who speak other languages other than Arabic. There are people who speak Persian or Farsi, the language of Iran. And there are significant populations of foreigners, particularly from places like India or Pakistan, the Philippines, or even Europe and the United States.
Yes, there's quite a few. It's one of the points that you make, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit, is the sheer diversity. We tend to think of everything, but we certainly tend to think of the Arab world as monolithic. We tend to think of them as conservative people who believe in Allah and veils. We think all kinds of things like that. And one of the things you discovered by being there was, hey, you know, this really isn't the case.
No, and in
they're just as diverse as the United States is.
If not even more so. And in fact, not only with cultural diversity, but religious diversity. These are societies, a good example. There are two vicariates of the Catholic Church in this part of the world. There are thousands, tens of thousands of Catholics in Kuwait, as well as in Saudi Arabia.
Practicing with no problems from the state.
No problems with the state, as well as direct, you know, priests and other things, structures in place. There are Catholic cathedrals in many of these states.
What about Jews?
Yes. In fact, the Bahrain, for instance, has a Jewish population. The Bahraini ambassador to the United States is both a woman and a Jew. A person who's related to her runs the most important electronics store in the country. Again, and this is a culture that has had Jews not only now, but in the past. Before the advent of oil, many of these states' principal industry revolved around pearls, and many of the leading pearl merchants in this part of the world were Jewish.
Yes, and in fact, the diversity extends even to the monarchy. You mentioned that the leader of Saudi Arabia, who had a number of wives, was perfectly willing to marry a Jewish woman.
Yes, perfectly willing to marry a Jewish woman. His son would marry a woman, Prince Faisal. The king you mentioned was Ibn Saud. His son, a very famous king.
For whom the country, of course, is named.
Sibin. His son, Prince Faisal, probably the most famous king in Saudi history, beloved by almost everyone, married a Turkish woman.
Yes.
A woman of Arab ancestry, but effectively a Turk, a woman who spoke Turkish fluently, had been born and raised in Turkey. And remarkably, we think of the Saudi royal family. We think of this part of the world as a place where women are oppressed by men, where men have for all these wives. He only married one woman. Throughout his entire life, this woman was his wife. She insisted on it, or at least there was some relationship. Sort of a remarkable.
She said, nobody else, baby.
Nobody else. That's exactly what she said. She would play an enormous role in changing the educational system in Saudi Arabia, and still well remembered. But it's sort of remarkable that even in a royal family, the Saudis that had prided themselves on their opposition to the state closely associated with modern Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, that they would allow a son to marry a woman who was effectively Turkish.
Yeah, marvelous. It really is fascinating to see that. Also, what about Wahhabism and Saudi Arabia?
Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia comes, of course, from the ideas of a man who lived in the 18th century. And the ideas have had an enormous influence that the current monarchy in Saudi Arabia, as well as Qatar. People forget that Saudi Arabia isn't the only Wahhabi state. Qatar, as well, a state that has close relations not only with Iran, but also with the United States, mm-hmm. is also a Wahhabi state as well. And Wahhabism is a particular form of Islam, of Sunni Islam, And an interpretation closely associated with the Hanbali school of Sunni Islam. It's a particularly conservative, but one I would not use the word reactionary. When many people think Wahhabism, they think of sort of reactionary. And in fact, when one looks at the ideas of Wahhab and of its ideas, it's much more diverse than one would think. There are ideas and openness to non-Muslims as well that are part and parcel of how Wahhabism works, as well as towards women and even to gays.
Now, yeah, that particular last one is very, very interesting. It's something you go into, and I want to talk to you about that. But Wahhabism is officially the state religion of Saudi Arabia. How do the other religions go?
How do the religions go? Well, I wouldn't call it a state religion. I would call it more state-sanctioned interpretation of Islam.
I see, yes.
Saudis would say we're not Wahhabis, we are Muslims. We are good Muslims, but practice a particular tradition. And indeed, within Wahhabism, there are various interpretations of what Wahhabism is. And indeed, the ideas of sort of if you go back and look at the 18th century texts of Wahhabism, they're not necessarily the same thing as what the practitioners of the faith, the religious scholars in Saudi Arabia, say this is what is good Islamic teachings. In fact, there are differences over time about that.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is the we tend to think of religion in general simplistically as a monolithic thing. Again, we tend to think about
right.
The Arabs in monolithic terms in all respects, and we do not allow for the diversity and for the complexity of their world. Their world is just as complex as the West, if not more so.
Right, and indeed the Saudis are a particularly complex tradition within the Arab world because, as you correctly pointed out, they were involved in the Hajj. And the Hajj, to remind your listeners, is one of the pillars of the Islamic faith. It is indeed the tradition that all able-bodied Muslims are called to make a pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina, which means that Saudis, because their kingdom includes Mecca and Medina, have to include and have to interact with not only Arabs and people around them, but also Muslims from every part of the globe.
Everybody's got to go to the holy city.
Right. Indeed, in the 1920s, when the Saudis were a much smaller state and were doing their best to expand and, in fact, conquer Mecca and Medina, they would justify their actions by publishing newspaper accounts in Indian newspapers. Well, that seems odd, right? India's far away.
Yeah.
Well, there's a very good reason for it. There were many wealthy Indian Muslims who would take on the Hajj, and the Saudis, in order to do this action, the military action, wanted to make certain that they had the okay, or at least had Indian Muslims who might be future customers.
Absolutely. That's such an important consideration. Now, I want to mention, we're about halfway through this show, that I'm speaking to my son, Sean Foley, S-E-A-N, Foley is F-O-L-E-Y, same as my name. And his wonderful book, The Arab Gulf States, Beyond Oil and Islam, is from Lynn Reiner Publishers, L-Y-N-N-E, Reiner is R-I-E-N-N-E-R. He talks about so many aspects of the Middle East that you are not going to hear about from the newspapers, including the analysts, and not going to hear about from the television, because a lot of people don't know these things. He's earned the right to do this because he's thought about it, read about it, and spent time in the place, which is quite a thing to do. Now, I want to get back to that rentier theory, which we began to talk about but never got to quite.
Can I add one other thing before we go further?
Sure.
You mentioned about how Wahhabism thinks about other religious traditions.
Yes.
One of the things that's remarkable, if you look at 18th century writings of Wahhab, the man who came up with this, this tradition, is he talks about how Muslims should deal with non-Muslim communities and tribes. And indeed, we think of the large community of non-Muslims in Saudi Arabia, many of whom have come to help develop the oil industry in the 20th century, is something sort of exceptional. And most books on that will argue, oh, the Saudis only allowed them in for a short period, sort of with a wink and a nod, and they're allowed to practice their faith as a wink and a nod, effectively because they needed them. And if they didn't have to need them, well, they'd be expelled. Well, if you go back and look at what Wahhab talks about, how to deal with non-Muslim tribes, and look at the way that the Saudi state has interacted with non-Muslim populations, including large populations of Catholics, for instance, in Saudi Arabia, it's pretty close.
And was it not Wahhab who had a basically don't ask, don't tell attitude towards gays? It was okay as long as they didn't make it public?
Not quite that way, but pretty close. Yeah, pretty close. There are multiple people who've done that. And in fact, part of it is that the way homosexuality and lesbianism are defined in Saudi Arabia is different and not necessarily as all-encompassing as the definition we have in the United States. But yes, both of those exist in the kingdom. They're not necessarily openly talked about, but they do exist at all.
And there are
levels.
Openly gay people who are prominent.
Yes.
In the Arab countries, who are on television, and everybody knows they're gay.
Sure. Or there are whole tribes that people talk about in Arabia who are gay, or at least practice that. This is something that is both sort of is there, and if you ask someone directly, they'll probably say something negative. But that doesn't mean that everyone doesn't know it. And in fact, in a book promoted, many of your listeners may know, called Girls of Riyadh, a book whose translation to English is actively promoted by the Saudi state, one of the characters is the parent of someone who's effectively gay,
which means
this is part and parcel of the society. This is not a society that bans that, in which homosexuality does not exist.
Right. It's a society which has multiple attitudes towards these things. We filter out only one and think, well, that's what it always believes. But in fact, what we discover when you're actually there and interacting with people, it has a number of attitudes towards homosexuality, towards various religions, towards all kinds of things. Now, we've been discussing, and in fact, you were talking about that National Geographic article in which the king is doing a traditional dance. And he's doing this traditional dance because kings have always done that kind of a dance, and it's very important that he do it well. It's part of his being a king. And there are other things as well. He can talk to his subjects, ask them to talk to him. He gives out money. There are all kinds of things, traditional things, that have been going on for years. Now, these are all quite apart from, because earlier then, the appearance of oil. And then oil comes, and these Western scholars come up with an idea. And what is the Rentier theory?
Well, the Rentier theory is, we mentioned earlier about from the 70s and 80s, how to explain this. And it's very simple, that states, because of the fact that they have ownership over oil, are going to be the ones that will get the direct rents or the proceeds that foreigners pay, major oil companies will pay to these states for the oil.
The rent is for the use of the land,
right,
drilling
the
oil.
Get the oil to pump it out of the ground. That's the idea. And the assumption is that the higher the price of oil, the more money these kings have, and the more money they have to act independently of their society, so they don't have to do things like, say, tax, that other kings and other rulers or political leaders have to do in societies that are not as rich in oil. And the idea is that political power is therefore defined by how much money these kings can have, these monarchs can have, through oil independently of the rest of society.
And it suggests that they don't have to have elections, they don't have to allow people to, you know, vote, to make up their minds about things. They can pretty much do what they want as long as they're not charging people taxes. They don't have to do very much except what they wish. And in fact, one of the things you point out is that has not been the case.
No, and in fact, two things that sort of mention that. First, over the last 10 years, as oil prices reached, you know, unbelievable levels, the opposite of what the Rentier theory predicts occurred. There were elections in most of these societies, opposition groups, people who, including women, who had not been allowed into the social political structures of these societies openly for a significant period of time, were allowed in. And so you would think if
they were especially allowed in because they were the ones who were getting educated and learning the new technology that you needed to learn for the computer companies that were coming in, modernism.
Or for any of the major companies. In fact, one of the most striking things when you mention about women, one of the chapters I write is When Only Women Will Work, is the fact that these societies, not unlike the United States or Great Britain or many other societies in the world, in which women overwhelmingly are the ones getting education, they're the ones who have higher rates of literacy. And because of that, they're in a position to succeed in society.
And this is interesting because it has implications for their relationship to the whole of the culture.
Yes.
I mean, how are they going to get to work? I mean, you know, what are we going to do about all of these women who are getting more and more independent-minded, of course, as they become, in fact, more and more independent? And also the men are less interested. You told me that there was something approximately the kind of situation there was like what was happening in Georgia. and where there are women who are getting educated and learning things, and the men are holding back and getting traditional jobs and being lazy about it all.
I wouldn't use the word lazy. They're not necessarily many of these men work in industries like construction and automobile.
Right, which doesn't mean you're lazy. Yeah,
no,
physically.
Physically, jobs are physically demanding. But it means that there are certain types of jobs that are not going to be open to them. And in fact, in Georgia, what they've done is they've begun actively recruiting men to train for positions and careers that we don't associate with men, healthcare, like nurses or education.
It's kind of like trying to bring women into the working place when there are only men. Here they're trying to bring men into the working place where women are really being the dominant force.
In fact, the recession that's currently taken on the last couple of years has hit everybody very, very hard. But men, particularly men without as formal education, have been hit very hard. The report that I mm-hmm. note at the end of the book actually in Georgia referred to it as a man session. Not sure if I want to use that term, but it emphasizes how badly ordinary sort of men who are sort of middle class, sort of what we traditionally see as middle class breadwinners, but not men who have college educations are being very much hit hard. And it's not just here, it's also in the Middle East. Both of these societies face, you know, enormous tensions about how to educate, how to keep families working, you know, when men can't find jobs.
Yes, this is a real problem. Also, it has implications which are very, very interesting to me. We tend to think of the way women dress in Arab countries as being a gender issue. And you point out that, no, it's not a gender issue. It's a modesty issue. And that the veil is more or less the equivalent of the dishdasha, the male headgear.
Or the headgear. Yeah. Yeah. If you look at say, take a look at a picture of a traditional Saudi man or the king, you'll see them wearing an outfit that covers just about as much of the body as what a woman's asked, if not more. And, you know, try it on. It's not the easiest thing to wear.
Yes.
And indeed, it comes from parts of the Islamic tradition that call on both men and for women to dress modestly. And in fact, it's interesting, if you look at pictures from the early history of Saudi Arabia, men actually wore different color dresses, different types of things, much more exotic dresses. One of the things that Ibn Saud, the founder of Saudi Arabia, did was said all men who work for the government must wear a specific dress, a dress that's consistent.
Uh-huh. So you'll know,
you know,
yes.
You'll know effectively who's in and who's not. And in fact, that was done earlier, and in fact was a sign of it. A good example I like to give is from Bahrain. Bahrain, up until the 1980s, men in Bahrain wore Western clothing. Indeed, increasingly in the 50s, they gave up the old Arab gowns for the Western clothing. But when Bahrain joined this alliance that you mentioned earlier, the GCC, the men switched back. That doesn't mean you won't find men, for instance, who don't wear Western clothing, but predominantly men would switch back.
You told me once, and we're going to have to wind up at this point. We're going to bring Sean back again, but you told me once about seeing some men on an airplane, and they were wearing Western clothing, but they're going to land in an Arab state, and they had to shift their clothing on the plane for when they emerged. Sean Foley, thank you so much. Dr. Foley,
thank you.
You so much for being on the show. The book is The Arab Gulf States, Beyond Oil and Islam. It's a fascinating book, and I'm not saying that just because Sean's my son. I'm saying it because it's a fascinating book. I've been involved with his thinking about this for a very long time, and I have learned, I can't tell you how much, from Sean. He has been the force behind some of the shows that you've heard here on my program. The Arab Gulf States, Beyond Oil and Islam, from Lynn Reiner Publishers, LynnReiner, Lynn Reiner Publishers. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you. Shukran.
Shukran, indeed. This is Jack Foley. The new issue of Bay Area Poets Seasonal Review is out, and its co-editor, Janie Dresser, will be reading tonight at 7:30 at Borders Bookstore in Alameda, 2245 South Shore Center in Alameda. That's tonight at 7:30. Tomorrow night at 7:30 at Moe's, Neely Cherkowski and David Meltzer will be reading. I'll be back in a week with more from Dr. Sean Foley. Thank you. Cool, calm and collected, Sally Phillips. And thanks for listening.
This finale of the 25th Jewish Music Festival takes place Sunday, July 11th and Sunday, July 18th in San Francisco. Check out the world premiere of Dan Plonsi's Bar Mitzvah with Dandelion Dance Theater at the Contemporary Jewish Museum on the 11th. On Sunday, July 18th, direct from Marseille, France, catch Watcha Clan, a brilliant Berber, Algerian, Sephardic, Ashkenazi, and French mix at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. Tickets $18 to $25 at jewishmusicfestival.org or 510-848-0237. That's jewishmusicfestival.org or 510-848-0237. This program benefits the Jewish Community Center of the East Bay.
And it is 3:30. You're tuned into KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley and KFCF in Fresno. Please stay.